Mandy, please schedule more episodes where I can throw hard programming questions at Opti for 1 hour.
Hosting and bandwidth provided by the Blue Box Group. Check them out at bluebox.net. This podcast is sponsored by New Relic. To track and optimize your application's performance, go to rubyrogues.com/New Relic. This episode is sponsored by CodeClimate. Over 1,000 organizations trust CodeClimate to help improve quality and security in their Ruby apps. Get 50% off your first 3 months for being a Rogues listener by starting a free trial this week. Go to rubyrogues.com/CodeClimate. This episode is sponsored by SendGrid, the leader in transactional email and email deliverability. SendGrid helps eliminate the cost and complexity of owning and maintaining your own email infrastructure by handling ISP monitoring, DKIM, SPF, feedback loops, white labeling, link customization, and more. If you'd rather focus on your business than on scaling your email infrastructure, then visit www.sendgrid.com. Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 128 of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel we have Avdi Grimm.
Hello, and since Josh helped me achieve enlightenment, I will now be known as Baba Ram Dig Bim.
I'm not saying that throughout this entire episode.
Josh Susser.
Hi, from San Francisco. And Avdi, it's about time I was getting tired of calling you your worship.
David Brady.
My code has an inferiority complex. Can we do something about that?
Katrina Owen.
Hello from Denver.
James Edward Gray.
I got nothing.
I'm Charles Maxwood from devchat.tv. Quick reminder, go check out goingroguevideo.com for my video on how I went freelance. And we also have a special guest this week, and that's Avdi Grimm.
Baba Ramdeg Vim.
Can I just call you Baba? Or is it Mr. Vim?
I am for him correcting us for the entire episode.
I'm going to call him Baba Dig Vim.
So, just to let everybody in on the joke, Josh pointed out that that Ram Dig Vim is an anagram of my name, and so apparently I have, according to my name, I have secret Vim tendencies.
What's in a name?
We always knew that. We knew before you knew, Opti. Really.
That's always the case.
Oh, no. This is going to be one of those episodes, isn't it?
Yeah. So what makes you think you could write a book?
I don't know. It was a dumb idea.
I think this is the second one we've talked about.
Do you have any idea how many words go into a book?
Lots, right?
Lots.
A couple.
That's crazy.
Way to quantify that, guys.
The bigger question is, how many words got taken out of this book?
Yeah, good question.
Probably not enough.
So Confident Ruby, why did you write this book? What's the point of this book, Avdi?
The point of this book is joy. It's about coding joy. It's about the joy that found in programming Ruby when I first came to the language. The way that things could be said really just straightforwardly in a way that was almost like pseudocode. And it's about rediscovering that joy even in the midst of, you know, not just toy problems, but really complex code. And doing that through patterns and idioms that emphasize telling code that tells a very coherent story rather than code that spends a lot of its time prominently dealing with edge cases. The history of this goes back pretty far. Back in the first couple year or two that I had an actual Ruby job, I was working with a code base that was a bit of a mess. Actually, it was a huge mess. Some of the first code bases I worked on are still some of the worst code bases I've worked on in Ruby. And I started sort of taking some notes and writing some blog posts based on the anti-patterns that I was seeing in the code. And a lot of them, I noticed that a trend that a lot of the stuff that was just making it painful to work through this code was that the code was kind of unconfident. Like it would constantly second guess itself. It would, there was, you know, if this variable is set and if this variable is a hash and if this hash has, you know, key foo and so on. And, yeah, just I started writing about this and then I wrote a talk about it and then eventually I wrote a book about it. So that's the long answer.
So what's next after the book?
The interpretive dance.
Okay. Once that's
I thought it was a book tour.
A screenplay.
I was going to say, Peter Jackson should be free in another year.
There you go, right?
Well, you need to have a trilogy before Jackson will do a movie.
Oh, Jackson will turn this into a trilogy.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be one. It just gets changed into one, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's going to spend the entire first movie just defining methods.
So, Avdi, I've been going back through Confident Ruby because I actually read it kind of a long time ago, and I was like, I got to make sure this is in my head. And this is something I noticed, just kind of this weird thing. I'm really actually trying to learn JavaScript finally, and I mean, like, actually learn it, like, how does it work and stuff. JavaScript, what is it? But as I'm doing that, I find myself doing a huge amount of defensive programming. Like, I guess that's the opposite of confident Ruby, defensive Ruby, maybe.
Paranoid Ruby.
Paranoid Ruby, yeah. Paranoid's a good term. That guy's going to steal timid my cocaine.
Is a term that I sometimes use.
What'd you say? Say it again.
Oh, timid is also a word I sometimes use.
Sensitive Ruby.
Sensitive.
I don't have a problem with being sensitive. I think sensitive is okay.
I find myself doing more of that as I'm working with JavaScript, and I can't decide if it's a JavaScriptism. Like, I'm scared to death of JavaScript ever automatically converting anything for me. So I try to make sure I convert everything, you know, so that I never let it get to that. I can't decide if it's that or if it's just that I'm you know, it's because I'm so new that I don't know what to trust there, you know, and so that's what makes me do it or whatever. But I find that I have that problem a lot more in JavaScript than I do in Ruby for some reason.
Yeah, I think some languages that try to be more helpful wind up being less helpful. I mean, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, and it's something that I honestly feel like I should add a bit about this to the book, is that Ruby, in contrast to most of the other scripting languages and just other languages that came before it, really does very little automatic conversion. Very, very little. It was kind of considered for a long time in a lot of languages, it was kind of considered standard that you would have all these different automatic conversions where, you know, I have a string, but I use it as if, you know, in a context where I would normally expect a number, so the language is going to, you know, do what I mean and convert that string into an integer. You know, you see this in Perl, you see this in JavaScript, you see it in C++, which is kind of weird. There are all these implicit coercions and things like that. And it seems like a good idea. It seems like a super big convenience. But Ruby really went against the flow by saying that, no, if you want to, you know, if you want a string to become an integer, you've got to say .2i, or you've got to wrap the integer conversion function around it. And I think that was probably a choice that was driven by the messes that are often caused by all these implicit conversions.
Yeah, and I think there was also a really good model for what Ruby adopted, which was how Smalltalk did things.
Right.
You know, Smalltalk had a very similar it's like they had the string type coercions that we see in Ruby all over the place, but they also had the genericity arithmetic conversion model,
right?
And it got adopted. So,
and I think it's very consistent with Ruby's, you know, sort of hardcore object oriented approach, because I guess the underlying feeling in these other languages is the language knows a whole lot about all of its built-in types, and it's going to, you know, try to do convenient things for you based on its understanding of the built-in types. Whereas the Ruby point of view is everything's just an object that you send messages to, and we're never going to make assumptions about what those objects are or what you want them to become. You just need to send messages to them.
Yeah, well, it's dealing with things in terms of protocols.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing that I loved in your discussion of all this was that you really clearly made the distinction between the implicit and explicit type conversion methods. And I thought that was the like the most succinct description of that I've seen, and I learned a lot reading that section.
I'm really glad to hear that, because that was an explicit goal. It wasn't a goal when I first started writing the book. I didn't go into it thinking, I'm going to write the definitive guide to conversions in Ruby. But it started to really become a theme. And I think that's because, you know, a lot of what goes into writing confident code is knowing what you have. Being sure by the time you get into the meat of a method that the objects you have to work with, not necessarily that they're the right types, but they support the right protocols. They are the right shape, so to speak. And so one of the major ways of doing that is performing various conversions on them before you get into the meat of the method. And so, you know, we have all these conversion methods like, you know, the 2i, 2 versus 2int, and 2array versus 2a. And so I figured if we're going to talk about conversions, we should really talk about it in depth. And there's really, I couldn't find any book out there that had a really good, complete coverage of all the different nuances of conversion in Ruby.
I actually have a theory about why that's the killer section of this book. I agree with Josh. It's about the section I really loved is like input in your book and dealing with input. So that's the conversion methods, but it's also like, you know, guard clauses and bouncers, I think was this other one you kind of described. I too thought that was the amazing section. I have a theory on it. You kind of divide things in the book from like collecting input, performing work, handling failure, and delivering output, I think. Mm-hmm. And so handling failure was kind of covered by Exceptional Ruby, and you actually say that at one point. You cover it a little, but most of that's there. And then, doing the work, you can't really help us with that much, right? And
right.
And output, there again, you know, there may be some patterns there, but it's not as much. But how to
output
handle the...
mostly about helping, making it easier for the methods that consume your output to also be confident.
Right, exactly, right. And then, but the input, it's a big topic, right? Like, data is always coming into the methods, you know, and then you have to decide, okay, I've got this, but I need this, you know, what are the good paths to get there? So I agree with Josh, and that's where this book really shines, I think.
So we've been seeing, like if you look at Erlang or Elixir or Haskell, there's a bunch of these languages that use pattern matching to do what in Ruby we would think of as method lookup.
Right.
Yeah, where, you know, in Ruby you send a message to an object, it looks up the method and then runs the method. And there, some of these languages have these patterns where you can say, oh, if you know, instead of just picking a method based on the class of the receiving object, I'm going to pick it based on patterns of, oh, did you pass me nil, or did you pass me a string, or did you pass me an integer, or did you pass me two integers, or what have you. And that's one way that you can remove conditionals from your code, is by doing all these patterns. And you're not actually taking conditionals out of the execution of the software at some level.
You're pushing them into the language.
Yeah, the language is special casing them for you in efficient ways that it can reason about. And I looked at a lot of the input processing stuff that you were looking at, the collecting input section, which really dominates the book. It's like two-thirds of the book.
I think it's the heart and soul of the book.
Yeah. And I looked at that, and I mean, this book is sort of a, you know, like 300 pages about how to remove if statements from your program.
In a sense, yeah.
it's like, oh, you know, it, you know, pretty much.
I like to think of it as removing the extraneous if statements.
Yeah, yeah. But it's very much, I think pretty much every pattern in here is, you know, oh, you can get rid of an if statement if you turn your code around and do it like this. And it seemed like that was somewhat reminiscent of what the pattern matching languages do, where they take stuff where you have conditionals embedded in the body of your method or your function and pull that up to someplace where it's easier to deal with rather than in the guts of your method.
Right. And the functional way of doing that is by pattern matching against types and against the shapes of structures. I think the OO way of doing that is to sort of turn things around and to push it into the polymorphism. So you decrease the one way of doing it, you know, is you decrease the number of if statements by increasing the number of types you have.
Mm-hmm.
Not the only way, though.
Right. Yeah. You demonstrated a few tricks on that.
So. So you do this thing in the book that is my new favorite thing. And you do it in the introduction for the very first time, which is you take this chunk of code, just this realistic chunk of code. I can't remember where you got it. Metric foo, I think, actually. And you go through with a highlighter and you highlight the lines that are about input and the lines that are about work and the lines that are about failure. And this particular example doesn't have output, but I've seen you do that too in like the accompanying video and stuff. But it's so eye-opening because you're like, look, you're dealing with input up here at the top like you should be. Then you do half the method. Then you're dealing with input again, you know, and just seeing those colors stacked on top of each other, really, just for some reason, that just is a super big aha moment for me about how these things are in the wrong order and intermixed and stuff like that. I love that trick.
Yeah. When I was doing the talk, that was what everyone remembered.
Yeah. Avdi, we've been talking about stuff in the book, and I know there's a book club, so we expect listeners to have read the book, but can you just say a little bit about this stuff so that if people haven't read the whole book, they can follow
like
along better?
The highlighting stuff?
Well, no, just like the breaking down of the method into input, work, output, failure.
Sure, yeah. So the kind of the epiphany, such as it was, that resulted in the talk and the way the book is organized was I was looking at these functions in these code bases or methods and code bases that felt really unconfident to me. And I felt like I was having a really hard time wading through. They were very hard to understand. And as a result of being hard to understand, they were hard to change. And I was trying to think how can I break down? I mean, what is the sort of real issue here? Like, how can I explain why my mind, you know, looks at this and just rebels? And I realized that, any part of a method, just about any part of a method, can be broken down into one of four parts. It's accomplishing one of four roles, sometimes more than one at a time. The roles of collecting input, performing work, delivering results, and handling failure. Any given line is doing one of those. And where methods become confusing, at least for me, is when those are all mixed together. And so I did this kind of visual aid in the talk where I would take a method that it was really long and had all these things mixed together. And I would just like James was saying, I would just mark it up in different colors, four different colors, showing which parts were collecting input, which parts were actually doing the work of the method, which parts were delivering results, and which parts were dealing with failure, and showing that, you know, it would just go back and forth. You know, we're collecting a little bit of input, and then we're doing a little bit of work on it, and then, oh, there's this failure case that we have to account for, so there's going to be like a three-line diversion where there's a begin, rescue, or, you know, five-line begin, rescue, end, and showing how to deal with that failure, and then we're going to go back to doing some work, but then there's some more input we need to collect that we didn't bother to collect earlier. And when I say collecting input, I sometimes mean going and finding input, like pulling something out of arguments or pulling it out of the database or, you know, descending through a chain of methods. But I also sometimes mean getting input into the form that we need. So sometimes that involves conversions as well. And, I feel like this mixture of parts of a method, is what confuses things. And a lot of what I'm going through in this book is sorting these out. So a method starts out by collecting input. Like there's a stanza where it's collecting input. And by the end of that stanza, there's going to be no more code in the method that deals with collecting input. Everything you need is ready in a variable. and then it moves on to performing work and so on.
Do you think those parts still belong in the method, or should they be extracted out? Like, is it a violation of the compose method pattern?
It really depends on the method. It depends on where the context and, you know, how big those parts are. I mean, certainly if you have a stanza, you have two different methods that have this virtually the same stanza of collecting input, maybe they're doing the same conversions or something on the input, then that's probably something that deserves to be extracted out. A lot of the stuff that I show here, especially when it comes to collecting input, is really intended to be, to go at the borderlands of your code. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, either code that's kind of right at the top level of your application, or code that's at the top level, you know, in the API layer of your library, where
controller
other folks
code.
Other folks are going to be calling into your library, and these are the methods that are receiving the inputs from external code. A lot of this stuff is sort of guard the borders. I don't really believe in, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do away with is repeating the same checks about data at every level. So I really hate seeing code bases where, you know, they're passing around these values and every single method from the top to the bottom is checking to see if it's nil first before doing anything with it. No, just check once and deal with it there and be done.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I love the guard the borders metaphor that you use there. And that's very often how I write my code. I think that's good. I think that's one of the things about object-oriented programming that's really an effective trick, is that you create an object and then the initializer, you validate all of the inputs to the object state, and then you can just rely on them from there on out. And I'll build classes where I do just that. You know, it sets up the object and then you can make sure that all the instance variables are set up right, and then you never need to check them again. And I pass state around in objects using instance variables pretty often because it's so easy for me to do things that way. And I have these very small bottlenecks that control how things get written so that I can always be assured that the values will be in a sane state.
Yeah.
And that seems so much easier to me than like passing around a value through, you know, four or five levels of method and having to validate them all as they go. And it's that's just like one of the things where the functional way of doing things, I think, is a little at odds with how you do things in an object world.
Yeah.
I think there's also a paradigm shift here, at least popping for me, which is that I tend to look like in the models directory of a Rails app, and I tend to think of all of these objects as somebody could just grab one of these and instantiate it. And I mean, that's what my spec suite does. It just grabs it and instantiates it. So obviously I need to guard my inputs, but if I'm guarding all my inputs up in the controller, then the proper behavior for a nil violation down in the model should be to explode and throw a no method error on nil class. And B, this is the epiphany for me, maybe I need to reconsider the fact that maybe not all of my objects should be always, you know, considered to be living on the border, right? Is there some way to say these classes are on the border and these classes are kind of in the protected area where their inputs are already checked?
You know, it's funny. I almost wish Ruby had Java's package. Level of visibility. We have protected, which is pretty much useless, very close to useless. And I would gladly trade it for package, because package, you know, all this protection is just advisory in Ruby, but package would be an advisory level to say, you know, if you tried to instantiate one of these objects outside of the module that it's in, that it's defined in, Ruby would say, are you sure? Because I think that's somebody's private and, you know, internal class.
I'm pretty sure we could write that in pure Ruby. We could use caller to get the location of where it was instantiated.
Yeah, and we could reduce our performance to a crawl.
Couldn't we create a refinement to make that work?
Too soon.
Hey, Avi. speaking of language level support, I'm curious that, you know, you have this breakdown of, you know, input work, result failure, and Ruby has explicit support for the failure section of a method, and you talk about that, you know, as, you know, getting away from the BRE.
Begin, rescue, end.
Yeah,
BRE.
And, getting away from the BRE and getting to the top level rescue clause on a method definition. So Ruby has support for that in the language.
Yes.
I'm curious, are there other pieces of this breakdown that you think would be useful to have some more language support for?
There's always the thought of let's add a little bit more to method declarations to enable us to be a little bit more declarative about what types of object we can accept. But it's so easy there to just start going completely against the grain of Ruby because, Ruby is not a manifestly typed language. It is not the sort of language where we declare types everywhere. So I'm not really sure how to do that in a way that would maintain the very dynamic nature.
Yeah. So maybe a different way of looking at this is, how do you think the Ruby 2 keyword arguments would change how you talk about some of these patterns?
It does change it. In the past, we used to say, you need to put everything in a hash and call fetch every time you get it out of there, right? And the keyword arguments are making that better. Now, I don't think they got all the way there until Ruby 2.1, which is release candidate now.
Yeah, required keyword arguments.
Right, really, because you couldn't do one that was required but had no default. But now you can in Ruby 2.1.
I'll be honest, I don't know if I've written a single serious program with keyword arguments, so I feel like I need to dig into that some more, and it'd be nice to release an update to the book that talked about keyword arguments a bit. This I think the target version for this book was all 1.9.3. I might have talked a little bit about some 2.0 features.
Okay.
Well, what I've found in converting some code to keyword arguments is that it generally, the language level support is helping. Because before, you had to declare, the variable that took the hash, and then you had, if you were pulling two or three things out of it, you had those two or three lines, which OBD calls collecting input, right? Where you're, okay, fetch this, fetch this, fetch this, here's the default, and now that just is part of the method signature, basically. So, but again, 2.1 is a necessary step, getting to the point where you can make Ruby actually throw an exception if that thing is missing,
Yeah, and that's really, really helpful. And just to be clear to listeners, when we say fetch, we're specifically talking about the .fetch method on hashes, so using those in preference to the square bracket subscript operator.
So you have another cool thing in this book. It's not just a book, right? You gave us the Confident Ruby book, and then you included about 30-minute video of you going into an actual code base, it was discourse, and going in and applying these techniques to discourse. So literally you would pause the video and then highlight the code in the various colors, like I was talking about earlier, and then let's see if we can, clean this up, and then you would play around with it a bit and do that. And then also you gave us a side book on a library you built on the null object pattern. We can talk about that in a bit. But the video, especially, one thing I noticed in there is that you have far better restraint than I do. So you go in, you find a method, and you're like, this is right for refactoring. And it's like, yeah. And then you do the one thing that makes 80 to 90% of the difference. And it looks dramatically better. But I would obsess over it. Then I would have to do the other 20 things that make up the rest of the difference. But you stop there. How you do that?
It was to serve the goals of the video. And the goals of the video were to specifically to show refactorings derived from the book. Refactorings that were about making the code more confident. And give me a chunk of code and I could probably refactor it, infinitely, long past the point of it making any difference. But for the video, I really just wanted to show stuff that was from the book, stuff that was about confidence. So I did have to really restrain myself. I have to say that it was one nice thing about the book is it did, or the video is it did give me the opportunity to sort of live demonstrate the marking up methods in terms of the different parts of a method. That process is actually kind of painful coming up with one of those pictures for the book. I wanted to do more of them for the book, but it was just, it's just this really tedious process. But the video process that I have makes it relatively easy.
I was going to ask if there was a way to, I don't know, mark these from a gem or something where it could actually give you that kind of readout or output where you could work.
I've been thinking
that.
About that for years. I mean, not so much the, like code analysis part of it. I'm sure you could do the code analysis part of it, although it strikes me as really, really painful trying to categorize code using analysis as input gathering, et cetera. I have thought about what it would take to like do something that goes one better on like the pigmentized tool where you could say, okay, from this line and column to this line and column, highlight code in pink and then like output that in PD, you know, in various image formats. And it's an interesting problem, but I think it's not an easy one.
So James, for the refactoring problem, the trick is to realize that the first one does solves 80%. And the next one solves 80% and the remaining 20. And the next one solves 80% of the remaining, 4%. And so what I have learned is that I'll do 80% and then I get up and I go wash my hands. And then I do 80% and I go wash my hands and I do 80%. And I have a sign that says, if you just got back from washing your hands, stop refactoring.
Yeah, that's it though, right? I mean, like, the one thing he does in the video, it's like, yeah, that's better, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, yeah, but we could do this thing. But then if you compare the thing I want to do with the thing he actually did, you know, it's like a 1% nothing change.
Yeah.
You know? It's so funny. But I really liked the video. I thought it was great as far as just getting to see it in action kind of helps put the whole thing together. You had some really cool examples in there. The anonymous user, which is kind of the, I can't remember if it's special case or null object, sorry.
Special case.
Special case, yeah. That one was
null object is a special case of special case.
Special case, right.
Yes. Nice.
But, and then you did one with dynamic dispatch on an after save thing. There were these different after saves handling like three different things. And you were so ruthlessly practical in that one, which is what made it so good. You were like, we could blow this up into an entire tree of objects and select the right object and then call a method on it. But in this case, it just doesn't buy you anything, you know? And I thought that was really cool. You talked about the different options and how you could go too far with it and yeah. Stuff. So let's just do this simple thing that cleans up the code and pretty much handles this case just fine, yeah.
I think that's one of those things that's the hardest to learn, you know, and it's hard to teach. It's one of those things that you keep coding and you start to get a feel for, you know, when a solution is just right and when a solution is overkill. But it is one of the reasons that I like the video format so much. And obviously I like it because I do Ruby Tapas for a living, but I love the video format because I feel like for whatever reason, it really helps me just talk about when things are pragmatic versus when things are overkill. And I also really like doing like recorded pair programming sessions like I did with Josh, and that's up on YouTube, because it just captures that thinking about this is too much or this is just right, that you don't see, you know, when you're just reading a pattern book, it's easy to look at that and think, okay, should I just apply this everywhere, or, you know, when do I apply this versus when is it too much?
Avdi, I didn't get to watch the video. I'm going to make sure I do that really soon now, though, because it sounds cool. You didn't talk in the book about how to apply these patterns in doing something like TDD. And I don't know if you do that in the video or not, but I mean, do you want to take a moment to talk now about like how does looking at things this way and the patterns in the book, how do you address all that using a TDD process?
Well, I think I feel like I wrote a lot of the patterns in the form of refactoring. So a lot of them start with code A and then refactor it to use a pattern and end up with code B. And so in as much as they are refactorings, you can they slot into the TDD process like any other refactoring. You know, you write a test, you make the test pass, and then you refactor based on whether there's duplication in the code or something else that's making you feel funny about the code. Mm. So yeah, there's that. I mean, some of this stuff, like when I'm writing the borders of my code, some of these checks I'll throw in without actually TDDing the check. Like, you know, if an argument, dumb example, an argument should never, ever, ever be nil. I may well throw in an assertion for that in the code without writing a test that says, and this method should assert that this argument is never nil. You know, if it's something that I need to, I want my client coders to be immediately notified about, I'll just put it in there. It's not the kind of thing that I generally TDD.
You can go like way too far down that rabbit hole, right? If you test every single guard clause, you know, or whatever. I mean, I know it's supposed to all be tested, you know, and stuff, but then it can get to a point where, you know, you're writing 6 tests per method you put in, you know, it's getting a little crazy.
And is it really valuable to document 4 of those tests? You know, this is guaranteed to fail. You know, is it really valuable to document, you know, 4 of those 6 guard clauses that, you know, if you screw this up this way, it's guaranteed to fail.
Right.
I do want to make it clear that I don't, like I said before, I don't litter my code with these redundant checks everywhere. It's really a borders issue. And it's a borders issue. It's about making sure things don't, you know, nils and things like that don't get too deep into the code. And it's about being kind to your callers and letting them know as soon as there's an issue rather than letting them know the sort of tertiary result. You know, somewhere deep in the code, you get a no method error on nil, and it turns out that was actually the tertiary result of, you know, 3 nils back in a completely different part of the code.
Okay. So, I mean, just to finish up the TDD stuff, the testing stuff, I'm curious if there's like particular testing patterns you find yourself using more building software this way. I mean, do you focus more on testing how objects get created and initialized? Do you mock things more or less?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that this stuff puts particular pressure on the way I test. I mean, I have a way that I like to test, and hadn't really thought about whether it was influenced one way or the other by this style of coding. I mean, in general, more and more I like to test based on the idea of roles. You know, I want an object to play a particular role, and so I'm going to name that object after its role, and I'm going to write a test. Often I'll write the test about what the object should do before the class exists, or even the name for the class exists, and I'll be like, okay, now what would be a good thing to actually play this role? But that's kind of standard, you know, test first, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I had one question about the code samples in the book. It's like sometimes they felt long. there's some, it's like I turn the page and, hey, this page is entirely a code sample.
I tried to avoid that, but there are a few.
Yeah, I figured you're trying to avoid it, but there were ones where it was just like, okay, I'm putting a lot of stuff on this page. And it took a little work to get through some of those.
I apologize for that.
Okay, well, I'll forgive you. But it's like you're so creative sometimes in the you know, code samples that you provide, and that's definitely entertaining. But it's like sometimes when you get one of these big long samples, I have to deal with like, why is it so long here? What's going on here, and why couldn't this be broken down more? And you know, it wasn't always obvious to me about that, so just, you know, it's just something worth mentioning because it kept coming up for me a lot.
Okay, that's good feedback, and it's good to know because I generally dislike the books with really long code examples, so try to avoid it. But it's sometimes
kind of a cool thing of the video is that it gave you a chance to tackle real code. You know?
Yeah,
and so then it kind of bridges the gap between, you know, in books, we always use like the dumbest example that you'll never, ever see in the real world. Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I mean, that's the perpetual conundrum of writing about this stuff is that if you want to just show a technique, if you want to highlight a technique, you can't surround it with a ton of extraneous code, or the technique will get lost in the code. So you strip it down, you strip it down, you strip it down until you've got something that'll just highlight the technique, and you go through it, and, you know, and then somebody looks at it and says, well, that's stupid. I would never write that much code just to refactor that tiny piece of code.
Yeah. Refactoring trivial code is always subject to the argument of, I wouldn't refactor this code. It's trivial. And that's a tautology, right? Yeah. You know, what if that Bruce Lee said, when a finger points at the moon, the idiot looks at the finger.
Right.
I've never heard that before.
That's great. And I got completely distracted by that because of elephants.
Sorry.
The thing I want to say about the long code samples, though, was it's actually great to have all the context. You know, it's like I actually thought about when I was looking at it, saying, okay, this is a really big, long chunk of code, but it's really nice not to have things that are obviously contrived examples.
Yeah,
you know, that don't have enough context to actually appreciate what you're doing and why you would do it.
Well, that's one thing harks back to the whole thing about telling a story, right? Is that you have to know where it fits, because if you don't have enough information, then the refactoring that seems obvious to the constrained piece of code may not be the right answer, because that may not be its role in the story that's being told.
Yeah. Some of this, I think, could be addressed by just better publishing techniques. Like, eventually, I would like to have in my toolchain the ability to do a long code sample, which is then marked up in such a way that you can see where the changes are easily. You know, it's like some books have the changes highlighted and maybe have some like numbered callouts or side by side explanations or something along those lines. I just haven't gotten my publishing toolchain to that point.
Avdi, you keep saying that code should tell a story. Are there types of stories? Are there like canonical stories that code should tell?
Once upon a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
15 unsuspecting teenage objects camp at Lake Crystal.
He's speaking of code versus environment.
Yeah.
What's that?
Code versus environment. You know, the story archetypes, you know.
Right.
Man versus environment and man versus man, et cetera, should be human versus human, of course.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, one of the ideas I left on the cutting room floor for this is something I've been thinking about for a while, is the idea that there are archetypal shapes for methods. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you can zoom out and actually see the shape. Like, you know, there's kind of the, I guess you could call it the flying V shape, where you have a number of nested contexts, like open an input file, do, and then inside the do end, open an output file, do, and then inside there, you know, iterate over a list of things, do, and, you know, and so you've got this steadily indenting piece of code that if you sort of look at it squinty-eyed, looks a little bit like a flying V of geese. And I do feel like there are these sort of archetypal method shapes. And I would love to catalog them sometimes, because one of the things I feel like is that if you can see the shape, if you can see one of these archetypal shapes, first of all, you instantly get an idea of, at least a vague idea of what's going on here. Dave Thomas, I know, used to talk about coming to under, like the way he would first come to understand a brand new code base is he would just dump it all into a Word document then use Word features to just zoom the thing out until he was looking at it spread across, you know, looking at the entire code base, or at least like a whole long file or something, zoomed out, just like looking at the whole thing on one screen. And of course, he couldn't read any of it, you know, it was barely little dots at that point, but he could see the general shape of it, and that would act, and then he could zoom in on parts of it, and the shape would actually tell him some things. And I do feel like, you know, if you can see one of these obvious archetypal shapes in a method, that's usually a good sign. And if you can't, if it's just like static, like white noise, you know, when it's zoomed out, then that's a bad sign. Like that's a sign that there's a mixture of concerns. There's a mixture of the parts.
Yeah.
I find myself noticing in this book how much you were dealing with the shape. I mean, a lot of times it was just, we can move this out here and look, now half the method is not indented anymore.
You know, right. Yeah. I'm a big fan of maintaining kind of like a cadence in code, and paying attention to the cadence of code, because I think when we have that, it highlights the things that are similar, and it makes the things that are similar look similar, and it also highlights the things that are different and, you know, should stand apart.
So what you're saying is Code Climate needs to incorporate Gem Sing. Do you remember that extension? You could install this gem plugin, and then you could type Gem Sing and the name of the gem, and it literally went through, and I think it was based on like when it would run into ends, or maybe it was classes and depths or whatever, but it basically made this like song off of the cadence of your code in a way. So it was interesting.
Yeah, that is cool. I never actually tried that, but that's definitely the idea here, is paying attention to the cadence, paying attention to the samenesses versus the differences.
So of all the things you talked about in the book, Avdi, what do you think is the most important?
What is the most important?
If you say kerning.
If you say kerning, you miss the point of the question.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, the most important point is really the philosophy that underlies it. It's the philosophy of not accepting the idea that because the real world is complicated, our code has to be a mess. I see this idea proposed regularly, you know, the idea that once the real world starts getting into once your code makes contact with the real world, you have to start adding all these special cases, and you have to start, you know, doing these big tangents in the middle of your code to handle a possible error condition. And so it's that kind of code is unavoidable. And I really don't feel like that's the case, especially in Ruby. I feel like Ruby gives us not just the ability to build abstractions around stuff, but to easily build abstractions about stuff, to quickly build abstractions around stuff. You know, we can easily encapsulate the idea of a context in which certain, you know, where the context has to be built up and then torn down. We can easily encapsulate that into a method that takes a block, and then the method can worry about the context, and whatever we put in the block can be the work that gets done within that context. You know, we have these really good tools in Ruby, and, you know, so the sort of underlying theme here is, I don't think, you know, that joy that you feel when you first write a piece of simple code in Ruby, like the first example that I use in the whole book is, you know, I was first learning Ruby and I encountered an example like 3 times do put as hello world end. You know, and that was like the best way of saying hello world 3 times that I'd ever seen. It was just, it said exactly what it was supposed to do. There was no, you know, for I equals 0, I is less than 3, I plus plus. There was none of that. You know, it was just very succinct. And it also had this thing where even the number was an object. You know, so there was that consistency there where everything was an object. And I loved that. And I guess a lot of what I'm trying to say is, don't accept the idea that you have to get away from elegance, that you have to lose that kind of expressiveness. Instead, leverage the language, use the tools of the language to make sure that as the complexity of your programs increases, as the complexity of the situations that you have to handle increases, your abstractions and your idioms increase fractally, so that any given part of that big complex system still looks just as beautiful as that, 3 times loop.
This might be the same question, but was there any part of the book as you were writing that you were surprised and delighted by, that you like unexpectedly, like as you were writing, you went, holy crap, this is a discovery that I made as I wrote this?
So we talked a little bit about how I spent a lot of time documenting Ruby's conversions. And there's a lot to be said about conversions in Ruby. I mean, there's more to it than just the, like, so there are the methods that are like 2i and 2a and 2s, 2str and all those different methods. So those are the implicit and explicit conversion methods, or conversion protocols is another way of thinking of it. There are also things like the capital letter methods, like the capital letter integer conversion function or capital string conversion function, stuff like that. But one thing that I discovered, or that I learned more about, is this pattern that Ruby uses internally, where particularly it uses it with implicit conversion methods. So an implicit conversion method is one of the, usually one of the methods in Ruby that is 2 underscore and then 3 letters. So like 2 str or 2 ary. Mm-hmm. But you'll also see like some longer ones like 2 path, 2Path is an interesting example. It's 2Path is used when Ruby internally, when there's a Ruby method that needs a path, like it needs a path to a file. Mm-hmm. You'll give that method a string, and Ruby will call 2Path on that string in order to, or it'll try to call 2Path on that string in order to convert it to a path. But a path is also a string. It's just a string with the sort of semantic assumption that this is a string representing a path. And the thing is, string itself, I don't think, if I recall correctly, string does not support 2Path. But what Ruby does is it says, if this object will respond to 2Path, then call 2Path and use the result. But if it doesn't respond to 2Path, use it as is. And what this means is you have an extension point. So there's this other class in the Ruby standard library called PathName, which is not a string, but it's an object specifically intended for representing paths, and it has a whole bunch of extra tools on it that you can use to like check to see if the file exists or if it's directory or write directly to it and all kinds of neat stuff like that. And it is not a string, but it supports the 2Path method. And so any of the methods in Ruby's standard library that expect a path string, they will see that they will implicitly convert that to a path string by saying, do you support 2Path? And it'll say, yes, I do support 2Path. And it'll say, okay, give me 2Path. And it'll use the result of 2Path, which is just the internal string that the path name object uses. And you can use that yourself. So like let's say you had a config file class, which represented the path to a config file in your system, but it had some extra tools attached to it. You could support 2Path on that, and Ruby, anytime you could pass one of those config file instances directly to an open call or any other method in Ruby that expects a path string, and it would just work because it would call it would see that you support 2Path, it would call 2Path, and you'd get that, it would get the string, whatever string you return from that, and it would work. So you've got this extension point where you can make your objects compatible with Ruby's expectations for a path string, even though that's not what they are. And even though Ruby itself doesn't know anything about your config file class. Mm-hmm. And this is a really neat pattern because you can, not only can you provide these conversions yourself, you can also mimic that pattern. You can have your own classes that will say, okay, if this object supports, I have an example of 2Coords, where it's, you're expecting a 2-element array, which represents X and Y coordinates. This class supports 2Coords, then call 2Coords and use the result of that. Otherwise use the object as is, or maybe it was otherwise use the object converted to an array. And now you have this extension point where if somebody else has treasure position, class, and it's an object of class treasure position. Well, they can also implement 2Coords on there and now their object is compatible with your code's expectations. And it's a neat kind of pattern. And one of the objections that I can see to it is that it kind of violates the duck typing, the way we usually think about duck typing, because duck typing is all about just sending a message and not saying, hey, do you support these messages? Are you the right type? Do you support these messages? Mm-hmm. But what I realized about it is that it's subtly different from that kind of duck type violation, because it's not saying, are you a duck, before telling it to quack. It's saying, can you give me a duck? Mm-hmm. And that's all it's saying. It's very constrained. It's not saying, do you support, this method and this method and this method? Cause I need all those methods, for you to work. And it's also not saying, are you this class? Or do you include this module or anything like that? It's saying, can you give me a duck? If you can't give me a duck, I'm just going to assume you are a duck and treat you that way. But if you can specifically know how to give me a duck, then give me a duck. And now, as I keep saying, now you have this extension point where other people can plug in their own things and have them just, convert, implicitly. Yeah. So, that was something that I became more familiar with. And I think I got more comfortable with the power of that pattern as I wrote this.
Mm-hmm. I did a lot of stuff like that in Java where that same type of pattern where I expected an inbound object to implement some interface that I had defined.
you know, that you're going to be coupled to this. And it's not quite the same thing, right? Because you're basically saying you're expecting this inbound object to quack, but it's not to quack. You're expecting it to convert.
Right.
And so I like that. What would that be called? Egg typing? Give me a duck.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good name for it.
I hope that name catches on.
This is great. Do we have time for another quick topic?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure, I've got one more too. So
I have no picks today, so sure.
I think one of the more interesting patterns in the book is using callbacks instead of returning status.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I got the name right there, but what is it? Callback instead of returning, number 4.2.
Right. And yeah, then it goes on to fancier versions of that.
Right. Yeah. And so I love this pattern. It's, you know, basically it says instead of, you know, if you send a message and it, you know, it can, you know, and it returns a status result, true or false or something. And then you do something with that result. You're saying, no, don't do it that way. Pass a block along with your, whatever arguments you send to the method, and then have it do the conditional within that method to figure out what to do to, you know, like whether it should run the block you passed in. And,
right.
And this is something that, you know, object-oriented programming has done for, you know, ever since Smalltalk, where you invent your own control structures. And
right.
I mean, functional programming has their own take on that too, but the, you know, it's ways to compose behavior, that I think it's a really nice way of doing things. The thing that, I don't think is clear looking, you know, the level of granularity in the book, I think, is great for describing the technique, but I don't know. The impact on what that does on a code base, I think, is really interesting. And
yeah.
It's like, can you talk about like what happens to your code base when you start pushing the conditionals down into the control structures in your, you know, block structured methods?
That's a good question. What happens to the code base? I mean, this is definitely a way of really embracing tell, don't ask in your code. So I like the example that I use in the section you're talking about is where we're importing purchase data from an old system into a new system. And you want to do something. There's an action that you want to attach to that. Basically, if an importing a purchase succeeds, then you want to send an invitation email with some new information out to the purchaser. And so like there's the version where you just have import purchase method return a true or a false. And then you can say if import purchase, then send the book invitation. And the alternative to this is yielding to a block when and only when that process succeeds. And this has some interesting benefits. You know, it eliminates an if statement, but what's really interesting about it is that it suddenly makes the code much easier to change to support batch operations.
Right. Or async, which you don't ever get into, but you mentioned.
Yeah, I never get into that. Yeah. But like, you know, this idea. So like with if it's just import purchase and it returns true or false, first of all, true or false doesn't say much. Like, you know, I have to go read the documentation to figure out that true means the import succeeded, or, you know, that's the indication of the import succeeded. But if it's an if import purchase, then send book invitation. Well, if I want to only send the book invitations to the ones that succeeded and I'm converting it into a batch operation. Well, then what do I do? Do I return like an array of trues and falses, or, you know, how do I handle the fact that it's now a batch? Whereas I can turn this method into import purchases instead of import purchase. And if it's taking a block that is called when the purchase import succeeds, well, now we just call that block multiple times instead of calling it once per method call. And that's the only change, you know, so it certainly changes your style in that, you know, the arity of operations, the whether an operation is a one or a many, becomes less important, or at least it becomes less glaringly obvious in the code. It becomes easier to change things so that, you know, it's do this when this happens. It's not, you know, it's not if this special value comes out, then, you know, switch and do this. It's just do this when this event occurs. And, you know, it's that makes it easier to switch to batches, and it also makes it easier to switch to, you know, fancier asynchronous stuff.
And okay, so callbacks are, these days, everyone thinks of Node.js, and you know, people look at Node code and say, "Ooh, callback soup." So how do you avoid having this technique devolve into callback soup?
Good question.
That is a really good question. It's not an issue that I've run into yet, and I guess I just haven't. I don't know if it's that I'm not using this stuff enough yet. I don't know. That's a good question.
Maybe that's the answer. Do it, but not so much.
Like, I, you know, as yet, I haven't done a ton of asynchronous programming using these patterns. And I think there are definitely some better patterns out there for when it comes to asynchronous programming. As a sort of general hand-wavy answer, I find things that do events in a pipeline interesting and sometimes easier to reason about, but that's not something that I'm prepared to like explain in code quite yet.
Yeah. So the callback pattern I think is great. It's a very like generically structured pattern, and you're using blocks to as a shorthand for things. But there's the old I guess Java doesn't really have closures exactly yet, but they're getting close. But in the early days of Java, people would build callbacks using inner classes and basically specially constructed classes that had a very narrow protocol that that would be used for doing the callbacks. And the pattern of callbacks you're doing is, okay, we're just going to use blocks. And that's great because we just have essentially one method that we're implementing, so we don't need to create a new class and then tell the thing which thing, which method it has to, it, you know, which message it should be sending. But is that something that you think about when you're doing callbacks? Is, I know you had one example where you had blocks within blocks. And when you get to that point, do you start thinking about, do I need to actually build some kind of specialized class to handle the callbacks?
That's a good question. You mean like having a class that maybe has various methods, you know, on this, on that, on the other?
Yeah.
I do think about that sometimes. I've used that in some of my designs. I don't know. Like, I think ideally it would be neat to have some conventions where you could do one or the other. And it's something I think about, like, building a library around at some point where you could easily convert a method into a form that would take either, you know, various callbacks for various situations as lambdas or as blocks, or it would accept a specialized object which supported various on foo callback methods.
An example of that would be validations in Active Record in Rails, where there's like all sorts of ways to validate properties. There's you can just give it a symbol for a method to run to do the validation. You can give it a block or a lambda right there, or you can define a whole validator class and then use that to do the validation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the big question is whether each collection of callbacks for a given call are one-offs or not. You know, if you find yourself wanting to handle, like, you always want to handle success by doing thing A, and you always want to handle failure by doing thing B, and you always want to handle timeout by doing thing C, then it starts to make sense to support some kind of callback object, because then you can just instantiate one of your standard callback objects and throw it in there and not have to rewrite the blocks every time. I guess that's the sort of turning point, is when you find yourself repeating a set of callback handlers more than once.
Yeah. I think that the point where it's like seriously obvious you have to do something in along those lines is when you start having like conditionals within your callbacks, and you can think, oh, well, I could use some polymorphism, and suddenly I have a couple different classes of callbacks. And
well, and that's another point is that I'm definitely not a fan of having a lot of code within callbacks. So, like, I've got a later example in one of these later patterns where I say, you know, import purchase, here date, title, user, email, do, and then the block receives a result object. And the result object supports these different methods like on success, do, and on redundant, do, and on error, do. Which I think is a really cool pattern. It's, you know, decoupling the action from the representation of its result. But within each of those, you know, on success do, on redundant do, those each are one-liners. You know, I've got another method. If it needs to do more than just log a little bit of information, I've got another method that actually handles what you do in there. And what I definitely don't like to see is a whole lot of code inside one of those callbacks. I like to see it delegate off to a method somewhere.
Okay, so it's effectively it turns into something like routing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So it's just, you know, connecting the event to the thing that handles it.
That's a great point.
Okay, so that's enough on that topic for me.
All right, one last aside. The third thing you throw in is a whole nother book. It's like a whole nother book. It's called Much Ado About Naught. You want to tell us what that is?
Yeah, that was kind of a thing that just happened. One of the topics that I talk about a lot in Confident Ruby is the null object pattern, and I'm a big fan of the null object pattern. Been thinking about it for many years, and as I thought about it, I thought it would be really neat to do just like build a library that captured all the different little variations that you can do on the null object pattern and let people play with it really easily. And so I thought, I'll go ahead and, since I'm writing this book that involves null objects a lot, I'm going to go ahead and write that library. And then I thought, well, since I'm going to write a library, I'm going to use Emacs and org mode to write it in a literate programming style, just for the heck of it. And what that means is that I basically wrote what I was going to do. So I wrote a little bit about what feature I wanted, and then I would inline write the test, and then I would, what's called tangling the code in literate programming, you write prose and you write blocks of code, and then you use your tool to tangle the code, which means it puts the code into files and in the appropriate order to actually be run, rather as opposed to be presented in book form. And you know, the test would fail, and then I'd write a little bit more in the book about how to implement that, including the code block that actually implemented it, and I would tangle the code, and then the test would succeed, and so on. And so basically I wrote the library by writing a book, and the original source code, it's since has been diverged, but the original source code of the library was the book itself. And I would just hit the tangle command, and it would all be taken out and put in the right order into files. And yeah, that was kind of a neat experience doing it that way.
I want a screencast of you doing that. I want to watch. Much Ado About Naught sounds cool, but I want to read the making of Much Ado About Naught.
And it also, and then I got my mom to do these delightful illustrations in, I think it's called Paint Shop on the Mac, you know, one of these really simple paint programs.
Yeah, it's got tons of great pictures in it. The book is cool. It's got a lot of humor in it, you know, especially in the intro. It's really funny. And then it's this like sneaky thing. I find myself reading it and I'm like, hey, what is this book about? Like, is it about how to develop a library? Is it about the null object pattern? Is it about metaprogramming? And I think the answers are yes, yes, and yes.
Yeah, pretty much all yes. I mean, I think first and foremost, it's a book about metaprogramming. It and the library were an excuse to kind of use almost every trick in my metaprogramming book and talk about each one in turn.
It's cool. And I mean, there's some neat moments where you refactor to command classes and stuff. It's really neat. I enjoyed, you know, it's an add-on, but it's definitely its own thing and was really cool.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I definitely had a lot of fun with that one. That one was just kind of pure fun.
Yeah, nothing like good, clean fun, huh?
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, should we wrap up and do the picks? This is going to be another one of those long episodes that people complain about.
Okay, let's wrap it up.
All right, James, what are your picks?
Okay, I'm on a video kick recently. I have no idea why, but I've just been watching lots of cool videos on the net, so a couple of those are related to programming. First, the changelog has this list of Rich Hickey's greatest hits. It's kind of cool. You know, Rich Hickey is the creator of Clojure, and so he takes a functional view of everything, which I find is good because it you know, challenges my ideas about things, and I like that. And there's lots of great videos in here. I actually watched all of them. The language of the system, just to hear him talk about what he thinks a system is and how our idea of an application kind of breaks down when we get to that point and stuff, I found particularly enlightening. But a lot of them were really good. So if you want to see something different, that's my recommendation. Another video I was watching recently about programming was from Baruco, and it's called Microservice Architecture. It was by Fred George. And this video is really cool. He's talking about what he's learned in building SOA systems through the years. And it's kind of some unusual stuff, breaking systems down to very small line counts, like 100 to 500 lines, maybe, with 500 being really big. There's some radical concepts in here, like throw away the unit tests for these services and instead track business metrics. Just stuff like that. It was a bunch of interesting curveballs. And the way I do my, you know, kind of talk listening is I'll put it on in the background when I'm doing something not too big, and I'll see if it hooks me. And this talk kind of got in my head, and I ended up having to go back and watch it the whole way through and see what it was about and stuff. You know, there's some stuff in here that I think would be difficult to apply in every case, but a lot of neat ideas in here, I think. So that's another expand your brain kind of thing. And then finally, for a less programming, more unusual pick, after doing the talk at GoGuruko, one of the cool things is that people talk to me about and send me interesting videos about relating to being disabled and programming or stuff like that. This particular video is somebody programming by voice command, which I thought is really interesting. I've seen videos about how terrible it is in the past, and I've tried it myself, and I always thought, yeah, if I was ever going to make this work, I'd almost have to, like, invent a language to program in, which is pretty much what this person did, is kind of invent their own custom language of stuff so that they could, you know, move cursors around or select certain bits of text and stuff. Even if you're non-disabled, I bet you'll find this pretty interesting. It's just a different way of thinking about the things that we do. It was cool stuff. So there's just some neat videos I've seen recently. That's my pick.
Cool.
Awesome. Josh, what are your picks?
Well, I've mostly been on vacation for the last week or so, so I don't really have any programming picks, but I have one kind of like fun, amusing pick, and that's this cool YouTube video of an animated optical illusion. So it's pretty damn trippy. So it's just fun to watch. So that's all I got. I'll have something useful next week.
All right, Dave, what are your picks?
As promised, nothing to report.
Katrina, what are your picks?
Today I have an alarm clock. It's on the iPhone. I don't think there is an Android app for it. It's called Ichi. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's I-Q-I. And it basically starts 15 minutes before you set your time, the alarm to go off. And it starts with one, like, Zen meditation bowl ding. And then it waits several minutes, does one more. And it uses the golden ratio to slowly increase the frequency of the dings that arrive. And then by the time you have to wake up, it's constant. And it's really, really nice. Like, it's a very gentle awakening.
Huh. If half an hour after it's time to wake up, does it progress to banging on trash cans?
I haven't tried that yet.
That would be awesome.
Hey, are those time periods adjustable?
I believe so. I haven't tried.
Because that's, that's often what we do when meditating is you'll have like you'll do that for coming out of meditation is you'll have a, you know, an intro tone and then you'll work up to, you know, okay.
I actually have a specific explicit app for that.
So I think technically this is a meditation timer, except I don't meditate. So there you go.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool. Well, I can use it then. Great.
All right. Avdi, what are your picks?
So let's see, things that made my life easier recently. I'll pick Google Now. So I'm on the Android ecosystem, I guess, and I've been noticing that Google Now has been getting really cool lately. It's the thing that you see when you go into Google search on your Android phone. If you're not familiar with the Android ecosystem, and basically they've started doing this thing where they throw various cards in there that are sort of context sensitive, depending on what's going on and where you are. And so if it notices that I've received an email about a package that's on the way, it'll throw a card in there that tracks the package. When I've been traveling and I noticed, like, the first two things that I wanted to go, like, look up were, okay, what time is it back home? And what is the conversion rate between dollars and euros? And I wanted to search and noticed that it already had cards there for what time it is back home and what is the conversion rate between dollars. And, you know, like the cards can be interactive. So there was a little card where I could punch in a number and it would show the conversion. So, and then just like the other day, it notified me that one of my favorite bands has a new album out. So, like, if you're cool with Google knowing every single thing about you, they actually do some pretty neat stuff with the information. So, yeah, Google Now is kind of neat.
Oh, very nice. I don't have any picks today. It's been kind of a crazy week. So, I'm just going to beg off. We do have another book club book selected. James, do you want to announce that for us?
Yes, we held the vote on Parlay, and the title that came out, the winner is Functional Programming for the Object-Oriented Programmer by Brian Merrick. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I don't know yet when the episode will be. I'll get in touch with Brian Merrick and see if we can talk him into coming on the show and talking with us about it. But pick that up and start reading, and I will try to get us discount codes and stuff too. So more information to come, but that's the book, Functional Programming for the Object-Oriented Programmer.
Awesome. All right. Well, we'll wrap up the show then. We'll catch everybody next week.